So good evening. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I feel really very fortunate to be part of the IMC community. So this evening I was asked to give sort of what's called a way-seeking talk, which is essentially a personal story, which you may or may not have heard such talks before, about how I came to Buddhist practice, and for me, how I've kept coming back and back to it over the years. And so that's what I'm going to do this evening. And I just wanted to ask folks, too, just at the beginning, how many people generally have some idea of the Four Noble Truths? That vaguely, you know, familiar with it. And it's not really necessary to know much about it for this talk, but in preparing this talk, I started to find that I was reflecting on the Four Noble Truths. And again, for purposes of this talk, you can think of the Four Noble Truths as essentially a basic understanding and path to practice. And I have to confess that the Four Noble Truths are pretty central to everything, and for many years I thought they were really boring. They just seemed so obvious to me, and so as I was thinking about what to talk about on this in this talk, I started thinking of the first noble truth in particular, and that is the truth that in some ways, not in all ways, but as much as life is delightful, it is also unsatisfactory in some ways. And so this can be seen as perhaps an entry point to how people come to practice, and because they feel some sense of this unsatisfactoriness. And again, my initial thought was, I don't think so. That's not me. But I just started thinking maybe I should think about that a little bit. And just before I start in full, in a sense, in essence, this unsatisfactoriness that seems to be part of life, manifests itself in many different ways. The mere fact that we get sick and that we die, not so satisfactory. And we feel pain and distress and emotions that we don't like and despair and all those sorts of things. And also, sometimes we think, if only I had the nice house, the perfect partner, that perfect job, if I always felt relaxed and sort of at ease, then I would be happy. And there's a way that most of us tend to keep grasping for happiness just beyond what we have right with us. And then I think there's a final way, actually, that the Buddha talks about life being somewhat unsatisfactory. And I like to think of it is that we don't really have the full story about life. And when we were born, none of us got the memo that really explained why we're here, what we're doing here, what we're supposed to do, and how it all works. And that perhaps because of this, there really isn't, many of us find, a resting point in life where just things can be safe and perfect and, life is all explained. So as I started to think about my personal connection to the Buddhist path, it really was this last sort of unsatisfactoriness that I think gave rise to my first interest. So when I was a teenager growing up in Kansas City, Missouri, in the 1960s and 1970s, my two parents and my older brother, I was very interested in what is the purpose of life and what are the ultimate truths in life. And we belonged to a very liberal suburban Lutheran church, and so it seemed logical I should seek those answers in the church. So I also have the benefit in preparing this talk that I recently helped my dad clean out the old family house in Kansas City. We lived there for 44 years as a family, and I had since moved away. So I was going through an old box, and lo and behold, I found a list, which I entitled The Big Questions, which was a list that I wrote to my pastor that I wanted the answers to. And the first one, there were 15 questions, and I'll just give you a flavor. How can you prove that God exists? Why did Jesus Christ die for our sins? Why did he want to? And why do we refer to God as a he and not a she? So, in essence, I felt that I wanted to know why I should believe in this Christian God and do the things that the Bible said when I simply saw no evidence that this God existed. And why should, as I conceived it, have blind faith, which seemed blind faith, in something that really didn't relate to my personal experience as I had lived it. So, unfortunately, neither the pastor nor the church really provided a useful answer for me. And even though they were very liberal, they seemed to just recite Christian doctrine, and it didn't really respond to my needs. So I soon declared myself an atheist, and I coined the phrase for myself religious atheist, because I believed an atheist could be a really good person, and so a religious atheist was a person who did not believe in God, but believed in doing really good things for other people and for the earth. So I kept searching, and senior year in high school, fall semester, I decided, well, why not take Mrs. Harter's sixth period world religions class? Sounded like a good thing to do, to keep searching. And I had a project to do to present to the class, and I saw these Buddha statues. And I thought, well, it's sort of curious or interesting what all those symbols mean on them. You know, there's something here, and then the palms, and all that sort of stuff. So I said, I'm going to do my class presentation on Buddhism. And I remember sitting there in Mrs. Harter's class, and I would refer to her as Ms. Harter today, but she called herself Mrs. Harter. And I was reading my Buddhist book about the symbols, and then I came upon a sentence. And it said that the Buddha's last words before he died were, "Look within, thou art the Buddha." And I remember to this day that my eyes just went down to that line on the page and said, that's it. That's it. That's really what I've been searching for. And that was a path that asked me to look at my own experience and not have blind faith in something that I was given no basis really to believe in. And I was thrilled, too, that Buddhism didn't have a God that I had to believe in. And finally, I read about this thing called Nirvana, and I thought that sounded totally cool. And that was something I wanted to attain. So my dad and brother and some other good friends from high school were thrilled about this. I thought it was pretty interesting. And some high school friends brought me a little Buddha, which actually I brought tonight to show off, but I forgot to bring it up here. They gave me a little meditation kit, and my brother sculpted this clay Buddha for me, and so I was off and ready to go. But then I thought, what's a new Buddhist to do in Kansas City in 1975? And there was no internet to log onto the IMC website and listen to audio Dharma talks. So I thought, well, Buddhists meditate. So that's what I'm going to start doing. And I saw that there was a transcendental meditation program in Kansas City. And so I knew it was not a Buddhist meditation. I knew that much, but I thought it's the next best thing. And I just figured it out as on my own as I went. And my mother was quite liberal and open-minded herself. But I remember as I was leaving the house that day to have my first meditation session, she sort of cried out. She was the Lutheran in the family. A fool and their money are soon parted. So I tried. I pursued transcendental meditation and then went to college soon after in Chicago, outside Chicago. Took literature classes relating to how Eastern thought related to Western literature. We read the Tao Te Ching and other interesting works in the West that reflected some of these Eastern themes. And I don't know how many of you knew or remember the so-called orgone blanket. It was an blanket that you sit under and you get the energy from the earth and the cosmos. So my professor had one of those, and I got to sit under one of those, and it was really neat. But unfortunately, I found it very difficult for me to pursue meditation on my own. And I was way too antsy, and I just couldn't sit and follow my mantra. And I was living in a dorm, and it wasn't exactly conducive to a contemplative lifestyle. And there were lots of things going on in college, and I didn't have support or community. There wasn't a teacher that could guide me along the way. And I think really, too, my connection to a real sense of Buddhist practice wasn't strong enough. I knew I was really drawn to it, but there wasn't enough to keep me going. So I drifted away from any sort of practice, and unfortunately for me, I fell into studying a line of coursework that I really hated. I found it quite unfulfilling, and I realized that a lot of it was really to meet the expectation, probably most of my parents, but what I had internalized as I thought everybody wanted me to do. And I was naturally a fairly happy, optimistic person, but I was just feeling myself becoming miserable. And I know college is probably miserable for lots of people, but I kept chasing after the wrong things, and maybe for many of us too, I was stung by the fact that I realized in college I was not the smartest person to walk the face of the earth. And I didn't have the greatest grades of any other person that was on the planet. And this was a particularly hard thing, I think, when I went to college, because I remember back my older brother, he was in first grade when I was 4 years old, and he came home and taught me all his vocabulary words so that when I got to kindergarten, I would be smarter than every other person in the class. So it was very ingrained in me, succeed, succeed, succeed. But I was just feeling stress, stress, and stress. So finally, by senior year, I had actually completed all the requirements that I needed to do, essentially a few more to go, and I said, I am just going to take classes that are fun. That's what I should have done in the very first place. But what did I find myself enrolling in? Poetry, art history, and with no prior Buddhist college courses, a graduate seminar on Nagarjuna's Mulala Mangalika Karaka, which is, that's what I said, but it's the fundamentals of the middle way. And it's an investigation of the Buddhist concept of emptiness or nothingness. We studied seemingly indecipherable texts which stated such things, and I quote, "At nowhere and at no time can entities ever exist by originating out of themselves, from others, from both self or other, or from lack of causes. There are four and only four relational conditions, namely the primal causal, the appropriating or objectively extending, the sequential or the contiguous, and the dominating extending conditions." And I said, thank God there is no fifth. I remember spending long hours in the library, staring at the stacks and the books, trying to figure out whether does that book exist or does it not exist? No, it exists and it both doesn't exist. Wait, or it doesn't not exist and both. And my mind was just spinning and, oh my goodness. So, but even then, I sort of realized I am not battling with this Buddhist text as I had battled against what was in the Bible. I trusted it in some way, and I actually trusted that it did explain the truth of the way things were, and I just had to figure out what it meant. And I just distinctly remember it was 4 a.m., late in the semester. It was about 4 or 5 in the morning, actually, and I was finishing my term paper on nothingness. And it was due at 9 in the morning, I think, and so, of course, I was pulling that all-nighter. But I had written out a rough draft, and it was before computers, you know, typing away. And then it just fell into place. And I said, I get it. I really get it. I understand what they're talking about when they say nothingness. And I didn't want to lose it, so I just kept typing on the paper, you know, and finished it, ripped it off the thing, and dashed to the professor's office. And a couple weeks later, when I got my grades, I was thrilled. Straight A, you know, graduate course in nothingness. And I guess in typical Buddhist fashion, I didn't make a photocopy of the paper. I didn't pick it up from the professor. And whatever I pecked on the typewriter, it left without a trace. And to this day, I could not tell you exactly what I had seen about nothingness. But I know I had made another connection, a deep connection to the Buddhist path. And at that point, too, my Buddhist understanding was pretty intellectual and philosophical. It wasn't so much about practice and how it related to life. And I, again, as I finished with college, I sort of drifted away from Buddhism once again. And I retained a fondness for the practice, but it really wasn't active in my life. I went to Boston after college and actually met a series of great friends I made, and I went to a church, ironic, from my earlier experience, and I was part of that, a very active member. And looking back on it, though, my favorite text to cite in the church were the Buddhist ones, like Ecclesiastes, "For everything there is a season, a time to be born, a time to die. Everything passes away, it arises and passes away." This is such an important part of the Buddhist understanding. And in the early 80s, I worked in a refugee camp in Asia while I was still practicing Christianity. But I found myself mysteriously wandering to seemingly every Buddhist temple that was in Thailand as I was traveling there. And I collected all these Buddha images as I went home to take with me. So I came to the Bay Area actually to go to law school in the mid-80s and practice litigation with a small law firm in the Bay Area for about 10 years. And you might not be surprised that as I pursued legal practice, my Buddhist practice drifted away even more. And I was doing reasonably good law. I was working in public interest settings, but I found myself surrounded by people that really didn't share the type of values that seemed to be important in the Buddhist path. A lot of emphasis on making money. And I wasn't really pursuing my passion, which I was soon understanding was actually the civil rights struggle for lesbian and gay, bisexual, and transgender people. So over the years, I also learned painfully that I was horribly mismatched to be a litigator. I hated doing that sort of thing. It brought enormous stress to me. I hated being at the office at 5 o'clock, not knowing if a call would come in and I would need to be there all night to file a brief for the next morning or all weekend for something that had to be done Monday morning. And I really didn't like the aggressive and confrontational aspects of practicing law. I didn't relish the idea of arguing with opposing counsel about, you know, who knows what. And I also had that theme that seems to reappear in my life, the pressure to be the very best lawyer in the Bay Area. And again, a bitter pill to swallow that maybe I wasn't the best lawyer in the Bay Area, and would it be okay just to be a fine lawyer? So I still kept a foot in Buddhism at the time. During one of those years that I practiced law, my partner Stuart and I, we took a long backpack trip around the world. And I remember we were in Darjeeling, India, in the foothills of the Himalayas at a little guest house and having some tea, I think, and I sort of overheard these British tourists, and they said they had just come from this place called Bodh Gaya, which is the place where the Buddha is said to attain enlightenment. And so I said to myself, I'm a Buddhist. Let's go there, I said to Stuart. And so I said, let's figure out how you get there, and we've got to go to where the Buddha attained enlightenment. So we trekked off to Bodh Gaya, and it was very hot and dusty, and we sat under that famous tree, the descendant of the famous tree, and it was a tremendous travel experience, but I didn't get any Buddha light bulb going off. It was a wonderful travel experience, but that was about it. And so I waited a few years later, and I was back in San Francisco in our rent-controlled apartment in Haight-Ashbury, and I was living my seemingly inescapably miserable lawyer life and sitting under a real lamp in that sort of dusty apartment, and then a real light bulb did go off. I was glancing at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I happened to notice a book review, and it was a book review of Sylvia Boorstein's new book entitled It's Easier Than You Think. And it sort of caught my eye, and the reviewer said, you know, there are many, many books out there about Westerners and Buddhism, and I don't know if we really need another one, but if you read this book, it'll make a difference. This is really something new, well worth reading. And I decided I'll just walk right down to the local bookstore that night, and I bought it. And in the next few days, I read it cover to cover. And so at that time, too, I was doing a lot of therapy because I was trying to deal with why I hated being a lawyer so much and also simply lots of issues that I found I really hadn't dealt with in my life. And I was pouring myself wholeheartedly into therapy and trying to make my life better. And when I picked up Sylvia's book and finished reading it, it was a moment when everything clicked. Because suddenly all the work I was doing in therapy about opening up to the truth of my experience emotionally, it suddenly came together with this long-standing interest I'd had in Buddhism. And I started to understand what all these philosophical things that I had become aware of really meant. And I really noticed, too, that I wasn't sitting there staring at Sylvia's book trying to figure out whether or not it existed. I was actually holding it, reading it, and seeing how this Buddhist path related to my life as I knew it. And that was a huge, huge difference and really connected me to the active path of Buddhism. And it was fun to learn at my next therapy session that actually Sylvia's husband, who's also a Buddhist psychologist, was my therapist trainer when he was doing his training in psychology. So I also noticed that Sylvia taught at this California Buddhist retreat center called Spirit Rock. And looked it up on the map and saw that it is an hour north of San Francisco. And at that time, Stuart had a work friend who had also started going to Spirit Rock retreats and events. And so we all went up there together. And when I was up there at the first day-long retreat I did, I heard that there were these things called silent retreats. And you could go for a weekend. And so I thought, I gotta give it a try. It'd be really interesting. So I went on the weekend. I thought it was pretty miserable. But there, I heard there was a thing called a 10-day silent retreat. And I just knew, I've got to do it. And so I did. And it was another truly, I was having a lot of life-changing experiences at that point. It really blew my mind out. I had never known what it was like to experience 10 days of silence. And I'd never really glimpsed the idea of how vast and varied the possibilities of our experience and our mind can be. And I really love the honesty of the Buddhist practice, to sit and be present for whatever's real, whatever's actually coming up in your experience. And I felt a sense of being home there, too. I felt like I had come home to a place that was really mine and was safe in a way. And just lots and lots of things, I think, happened at that time. And my eyes were wide open, and it was super hot. It was the middle of summer there. And I found myself torturing myself, my bare feet, on these sharp rocks because I wanted to learn about pain. And what did it feel like? And what were my reactions to it? And I never could believe that I could actually work through an emotion and have it not be real and held with me. And I remember it was probably the first time I really found out that everything going on in my mind and what I thought was not necessarily true. And all the stories and projections I made up were, you know, projections. And after a retreat, I learned it was so much was imaginary. So it was a huge, huge eye-opening experience, and one of great peace at different times, too. So I was hooked, and I remember one of the teachers cautioned at the end of the retreat, do not make a major life decision in the next 2 weeks, because you're really in a sort of altered state of consciousness, really. You know, you've been in silence all this time, so don't, you know, change your life. So I dutifully waited 2 weeks, and then the next day I quit my job. And I was thrilled. I knew it was the right thing to do. I also will say that it was difficult, too. I remember my dad, who's enormously wonderful and supportive person, asked me over the phone, "So what are you going to do? Wash cars?" As if washing cars were a bad thing to do. But when he said that, too, it brought into focus the fact that really, up until that moment, and during that moment, I could not conceive of my self-image of that being other than a lawyer. I just couldn't think of thinking myself other than being a lawyer. And now that some years have passed, as I sit here tonight, I can't imagine that my self-concept ever was being a lawyer. that would subsume who I thought I was and needed to be in order to be here on this planet. So I went into Buddhist overdrive. I did another 10-day retreat that fall, a 2-week retreat a couple months later that was for supposedly senior students, which with me being there, I hadn't practiced even a year. I was hardly senior. More and more retreats, 2 weeks, and then a year or two later, 6 weeks, and then 3 months, all silent, you know, retreats, and next year, another 3 months, and another 2 months, and it was amazing. And I think, thinking about all that time in silent retreat, one of the incidents that I truly cherish, actually, I was in the 3-month retreat at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And right in the middle of the retreat, my aunt, who was really a kindred spirit to me in life, we just, sometimes, you know you're made out of the same fabric and just relate to things so, so well. She died right in the middle of it. And I was in charge of her affairs, and so I had to leave the retreat and deal with the probate court and her house and plan her funeral and speak at her eulogy. And I was a little disjointed, but I realized doing that in the midst of a 3-month retreat really was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life because my heart was open. And I felt the sadness and the grief and the memories about her. They just really flew they just flowed effortlessly through me. And I was there to experience them. And I felt such connection with other people, the way I really wanted to do at a family time like that. So I also found on those long retreats that I just increased my depth of understanding of the path and the Buddhist teachings enormously because I literally bathed myself in talks, you know, week after week, and I developed much better mindfulness and all sorts of really good things, personal healing things and, you know, amazing meditative states when you're in silence that long a period of time. But I also started to realize that something was not quite right here either. And I found that I was sort of disoriented between the retreats, and I wasn't exactly functioning healthy in ways in the world outside of retreats, and didn't have a really strong daily practice that I could come back to, and no longer being a lawyer, but not really a Buddhist monk either. And I felt a little aimless. You know, I didn't know what I was doing and, you know, just sort of wandering. And I also realized that even though there was a sanctity about this silence, and I really loved it in one way, that it's naturally actually a quite social person. I liked talking to people. And spending all this time in isolation was taking a toll on me. And it was very stressful and in some ways, and I was just exhausted at the end of these retreats. And I hadn't slept much through them. And I found that something else, as I thought about it more, is I was opening up to all sorts of emotions and difficult things, but I was seeing I don't really quite have the ability to hold them all. I was in an interview, I particularly remember, at the end of the last long retreat I did, and I was reporting this very positive way, you know, I feel so open, And the teacher then just sort of said, well, you should be open and mindful. Not just open, but you should be able to hold it. You should be mindful of it. And I saw at that point, you know, I'm not really able to hold these things the way I really would like to. And I come to think that because I seem to be having the most traumatic experience of anybody on the retreat and dealing with all these energies, that I was the best meditator. Once again, that theme. I'm a better meditator than anybody else. And then I heard somebody comment that their retreat was sort of smooth, pretty happy, you know, uneventful. I thought, maybe they're telling the truth, you know. Maybe there's some different ways to go about this. And I started thinking, and once again, why do I really have to do all these intensive retreats so quickly? And again, this theme of being the type A meditator, the type A Buddhist, competitive Buddhism, you know. I was going to sit longer than anybody else. So I kept with the path. I was still totally sold and connected, but I saw it was time to change course a little bit. So hiatus for long retreats, and I wanted to attend to daily practice and cultivate happiness in life and more stability in my meditation, rather than start turning to these different emotions and bodily sensations. Build a foundation. And coincidentally, at that point, I was asked if I would come to a residential facility for otherwise homeless, transgender, and queer youth on the streets of San Francisco who had been essentially kicked out of their homes all over the country and made their way to San Francisco as a possible place that they could find support and live in a healthy way. And they were facing a lot of difficult circumstances. And they asked me, teach them the most simple breath meditation. In-breath, out-breath. In-breath, out-breath. And I said, that's what I need to do too. And we just worked together. And I started cultivating this very simple ground of concentration and meditation. And I found it enormously, enormously valuable. And I also started thinking about happiness. And I was participating in this program called the Dedicated Practitioners Program at Spirit Rock. And we had the luck of hearing from a monastic who was from a Burmese monastery, who sort of had a different cut on how you practice Buddhism than what we tend to do here. And there are great parts of both paths. There are many different paths of Buddhism, obviously. But the way it was explained to me that their sense of practice was that the path is not paddling up the river, as I put it, a Sisyphean task of trying to get to happiness by finally paddling up the river. But actually the Buddhist path was establishing this foundation through breath meditation and concentration and a sense of well-being about yourself, and then getting in the river and floating down the river and using that oar to work the currents and explore the river. And it didn't have to be such a struggle. It was going to be difficult at times, but the fundamental notion of the path was going down the river. And I started to think, yeah, I was just paddling, and torturing myself, really. And this was very, very useful for me to have a different way to think about it. So I embraced much more the practice of the so-called Eightfold Path, which is actually the fourth noble truth, that there is a path that encompasses our entire lives, the way we interact with people, the way we speak, the things we do to make money, to support ourselves. There's an entire path here that really, it integrates with meditation practice, but in some way, it's the foundation that you really need. And traditionally in Southeast Asia, you practiced this before you went on to the advanced techniques of meditation, which were much harder to do. So I really tried to embrace that sort of thing, and I was very interested in doing a more engaged Buddhism. And so for the last 3 years, I've had the great opportunity, as luck would have it, to practice this in the context of the struggle for equal marriage rights for same-sex couples, and in fact, all LGBT people in California. And it was the morning of February 12th, 2004, and I don't know how much, if all of you were here in the Bay Area at the time or remember about that day, but I came to City Hall with Stuart to attend a rally in favor of gay marriage. And it was going to be held at the steps of City Hall. But when we got there, we learned that no rally today. San Francisco is actually granting marriage licenses to any two human beings, regardless of your sex, regardless of your gender identity, regardless of your sexual orientation. And we were right there, just as it was starting, and we dashed inside City Hall, and we happened to be one of the first 10 couples to get married. And as we were coming in City Hall, this Chronicle reporter for the newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, sort of tugged on my sleeve and said, "Hey, no one's done this before. Could I follow you through it? And would you just, like, tell me, like, everything you're experiencing as you go through it? You know, what's it like?" And I realized at that point she was my bodhisattva, because she was asking me to sort of meditate, to sort of practice mindfulness of this experience out loud to her. And so, because of that, there were Stuart and I in City Hall together. CNN had just arrived, and the clique lights, and people scribbling notes, and people screaming with excitement and chaos and euphoria. But the two of us were present for this unforgettable moment when we heard these words call out, "By virtue of the authority vested in me by the state of California, I pronounce the two of you spouses for life." And it was a moment that I was present for, and I just felt this tingling go through my body. I felt years worth of shame as a gay man sort of melt away. They came back some, but they melted away, and I realized in that moment that I had never, ever felt that my government was treating me as a really equal human being and saying that I had the capacity to love and have a family with another human being just like anybody else could. And I really appreciated how the Buddhist mindfulness wake-up call had allowed me to be there and not just get lost in the chaos and the euphoria. And since then, Stuart and I have, we've really tried to integrate Buddhist practice into what we do to advocate for marriage equality. And we do that by simply trying to speak the truth of our experience. What is true for us as we are here in this world? Not argue about issues and concepts that you'll never find an answer to, like the Buddha said, if you try to find out the meaning of the universe and how it all got here, you're just going to never agree on anything. We also chose to talk in terms of simple harm and benefit to real human beings. Just as the Buddhist path is very concerned about, is my behavior or conduct causing harm or benefit to other people? And something that was sort of magical a couple of weeks ago, one of the advocacy organizations working on this spent thousands of dollars doing state-of-the-art, focus group, poll-driven research, and we were just really tickled to see they came up with the same conclusion that the Buddhist path, of course, had offered 2,500 years ago. So we find this advocacy work to involve just all sorts of things that are so much, the Buddhist path is so youthful to employing, and simply getting along with people and trying to look at intent. You know, when people have so many different interests and they're really strong-willed people, both for and against you in this work, and to really focus on intent, which is, again, what Gill really teaches a lot about, and about when you're really contemplating your karma, look very closely at what you intend. And that's been a very useful touchstone because as you become an advocate and appear in the media and television, it can be very ego-driven, and organizations can have their intents too, to, you know, further their organization, and to really come back to what are we really trying to do here, and how do we really try to go back to those fundamental purposes. I found it enormously valuable. And I might say, lo and behold, my meditation practice today is even better than it's ever been. By relaxing around it, I think. Going back to those simple things and seeking places where I thought I could move with confidence and where I could move from a strength of mind rather than just struggling against a difficulty. So I think that's about my story for this evening. It's the journey from Mrs. Harter's six-period class to the marriage equality struggle. And I just wanted to make just a final closing remark or two about that first noble truth, which I spoke about at the very beginning. And I think you can tell from my talk, I have had a lot of suffering and unsatisfactory experience in this life, and that it has served as a basis to draw me back and back over and over into the practice. And I really think the practice, though, too, offers at base real hope and optimism. And I realized, I essentially feel this sort of intuitive connection to the practice, to Buddhism. And I sort of thought, how could I sum that up? And I just sort of said to myself, the Buddhist path really explains the world to me in a way that nothing else I've found does. And it gives me a way to examine my experience and examine what's happening in life in a way that nothing else had. And it serves as a guide, as something to reflect off of as I try to make my way of how I act in this life, what I do, and how I am with other people. And so, for all of those reasons, as we say in the law, that's why I'm sitting here tonight with you all. So, thank you very much. So we could sit, why don't we just sit quietly just for a moment, and then it would be delightful if people wanted to make comments, if they had questions, if they want to see my original Buddha statue. Anybody have something they'd like to contribute or share? Or
hello, and thank you. It was very nice. It just occurred to me that I thought of you seeking Buddhism from a young age, and that I was a seeker in a way, but Buddhism was not anywhere near my corner of the world. But part of Buddhism, and you mentioned it at the beginning, of emptiness and co-arising, dependent co-arising, and death was always of interest to me, even from a very young age, because of that prayer that we were taught when we were little tiny children that said, if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord must. And I spent many hours thinking about what that meant. And so I just made that connection. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And that's something I realized about this first noble truth, that it's considered one of the most sophisticated things when you see unsatisfactoriness so that all things, you know, are impermanent and have no substance. I sort of think, you know, this is actually a pretty common experience that we really struggle with what we're doing here and why we're here. And for many of us, we do feel this sense of unsatisfactoriness. We might not articulate it that way, but it's actually a pretty common experience. I also like to make a plug for public high school. This was your good old public high school, world religions class, cross-cultural education, and it made a huge difference for me, you know.
In Kansas, no less.
In Kansas. feel free if somebody wants to say something about your own practice or, you know, meditation or questions. It doesn't have to be related to, yeah.
Your mate is also Buddhist?
Well, one friend of mine said he was just born with Buddha nature. And because, you know, I've tried to, like, beat it into him that life is really that unsatisfactory. I don't particularly believe in rebirth myself, or I don't get caught up in it, but some people say he just has way too good a rebirth. but he experiences life as pretty calm and even, and I'm a much more emotional person and much more prone to the ups and downs, and he is a very stable person who can hold a lot of experience in an unconditional way. But I think he's gotten a lot of Buddhist practice through osmosis. Mm-hmm. Because when I would come home from a 3-month retreat, he would say, I want to hear everything. You know? And if I was quiet for a day, he'd say, you haven't told me anything. And so he doesn't formally practice in sort of the same way I do, but he's very attuned to it. And I feel it's something that is a shared thing, but in a little different ways.
I was wondering whether or not you give each other feedback when you notice things from a Buddhist perspective in each other.
Mm. That's very interesting. I think the way it works for us is I give more formal feedback. I would more put it in the context of here's what the path says about it, or if we're having a difficult time, you know, talking about something, I say, okay, let's go back to what's happening physically for us, you know, what's in our bodies with all this, how are we feeling emotionally, and I really come back to that thing of intent. It really is so useful. What do we intend by this? And then it can help melt away some of the higher, you know, the more superficial argument. I think the way he gives feedback to me is that he does have a very calm and embracing nature. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of this ability to hold experience. And it's a really, really useful thing for someone like me to have, because I have a lot of strong experience, which I can give to him, but holding it sometimes is another thing. Yes, please.
It was inspiring to hear your muddled non-existence full life. I really enjoyed that. Also, if we all had gotten our intention earlier, you probably wouldn't have gone into the legal path that you went into in college, I guess it must have been, that you studied that. And how do we awaken young people to their intent earlier? I guess you're doing it through your practice with young men and women.
Well, a couple things on that. One thing that I found that I really love about the marriage equality advocacy is because it seems to be a uniting of my interest in legal things and civil rights and something that, as you know, I talked about, is deeply spiritual in a sense, that the way we make the deepest progress, the most progress, is trying to connect with another person about our shared humanity, which is so much of the Buddhist method. What I try to do about the first thing you were saying about connecting young people to their intent is I guess I figured out that something that was really not so useful or skillful in the way I was being raised is, from a very early age, I just had these ideas of what I had to do. And I really felt I had to please other people, especially my parents. And it really stripped away the ability for me to really understand what I wanted and to be able to say, I really think this is interesting and I really enjoy this, so that's what I'll study in college. So I've tried to use what I've learned about that, and actually we have a good friend. I went to law school with her mom, and her dad, I've known for almost 25 years, and their daughter is just about to go to college. She's trying to figure out where to go and what to do. And I started to notice that certain one of her parents had really strong expectations. And I could see, since I've known her since the day she was born, you know, that I could see her, I could see sort of, you know, you're responding a little the way that I remember responding myself in high school and trying to be, you know, work so hard to be the very best student, get the very best grades and all this sort of stuff. So what I tried to do was actually with them, when they're having a big fight actually about this, offer a different way to maybe talk about it and talk about it in these classic sort of I statements and bring back these things of what do you intend and what do you think about it. And they went around and just talked about it much more peacefully. And so I try to take that framework, and when I can see it and identify with maybe somebody else going through a little of that struggle, try to give that person a little more breathing space and offer the idea that you don't quite have to do what you think that, you know, other people want you to do.
I just try to counsel. Time's up.
Sorry.
I just try to counsel, just basically follow your heart. You may not gain great wealth or stature, but you have a better chance of being happy. And so, and if you do that, the shoulds in your life tend to filter out.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I started to see about my connection to Buddhism. You know, that's when I was thinking of what to say, you know, how or why did I come to this? I was saying, I like it. I think it's cool. I just really like it. It's more complex than that, of course, but I think you're really right. If to be able to come back to a well-reasoned intuition, you know, I think it's a really valuable.
I think you tend to tack back and forth. I mean, if you've never sort of followed the things you love, then you probably will be misdirected into areas that maybe unhelpful, unskillful, but again, it goes back to intent, and if your intent is fairly clean, you'll right yourself, and you'll kind of tack to a general good direction.
And I found that sort of thing very, I found myself reflecting on that when I saw these mixed motives of being on retreat, you know, to be the super meditator, but there was some pretty good basic intent. I really wanted to follow the practice. So it was worth it to follow that intent, even though we've got the type A meditator thing going on, too. Yes, please.
I just wanted to follow up on that. You said you talked about being on a retreat. Yeah, and I'm pretty new to the practice, and it sounds very appealing, but I'm intimidated at the same time. So I'm just wondering if you could tell me more about what it's like to be on a retreat, and I'm just afraid, like, of all these emotions that are just going to come up, like you mentioned, and I'm sort of a type A type of meditator, too, so I'm afraid that, you know, it's going to be something that might turn me off to meditating.
Well, I guess the way I would, after my experience, or with my experience, this is a student talking to a student, really, is that I think it's really very valuable to develop a pretty strong practice outside of retreat before doing the retreat. And that's something that I realized was missing for me. I didn't bring it back to having a strong meditation day-to-day practice. And so I would experience all this in retreat, but it probably then was lost on me in some way, or I don't know, everybody's different, but having a pretty solid foundation, I think, can really help than when you're on retreat, too. And I guess, you know, one thing they say about the retreats is that in order to really get into it a little more, you really need about 10 days, because you need to get over that hump. See, if you go for a weekend, just by the time you've sort of finally gotten there and sort of dealt with, this is sort of weird and, you know, and stopping your life, then it's over. And so a 10-day period, and I guess I also, I would check in about your your essential emotional health if you feel like, I'm doing okay. Because I don't think a 10-day silent retreat is necessarily the best thing if you have some major emotional things you're trying to work out and find yourself out there in a silent retreat where you might not have the support you need, or you might not, conversation might be very useful, and these tend to be silent retreats. I think now there are a lot more retreats that integrate talking with silence.
So when you say silent, it's completely silent
time? Well, it's intended to be completely silent. You have an interview. They're structured a little differently. You have an interview with your teacher for, 10, 15 minutes, either every 2 or 3 days. And there's a question and answer period for about 15 minutes in the morning. And a Dharma talk is given at the evening, just like this. But otherwise, it's completely silent. And I would say that as much as I gave those cautions, I know that going on that 10-day retreat was a fabulous thing to do. And if you have this inkling, this curiosity, I think that's well worth following, because for me, 10 days in silence, as I said in the talk, it just changed the world for me. I had no idea the capacity of mind, the possibility of the human experience. And if you have a inkling to do it, I would go for it and just try to do it at the right time and get yourself ready and know what you're doing. Okay. So thanks.
There's sometimes hard to find 10 days.
Yeah,
I say weekend ones.
But Andrea Fella will be doing in the fall a something called a householder's retreat, where you meditate in the morning here, and then in the evening, and there's opportunities, different opportunities here at IMC to enable you to sort of further your practice, not only coming here to meditate, but there's also half-day sittings and all-day sittings. And as mentioning, Andrea Fella does a fall householder's retreat where you it's pretty focused structure. You try to structure meditation through your busy day, but you meditate in the morning, meditate in the evening here, and it ends with a full-day meditation. It starts with a half-day meditation. Doing that peppers. And it's just steps to sort of strengthen one's practice. And then when hopefully we have time to go on a 10-day retreat, you've got, sort of that muscle there.
Thank you. And I want to be very respectful of people's time. It's 9:02. So I want to say what a pleasure it's been to be here again. And as is traditional in the Buddhist path, is to say in some form that I hope, and may it be, that the benefit that we all have from the Buddhist path this evening and otherwise be for the benefit of everybody and for all beings on the planet.